I'm deathly allergic to peanuts. It's something I've had to deal with all my life. I always carry an EpiPen with me, and I only go to restaurants that I trust. It's an inconvenience for sure, but I've learned to live with it. It helped that my husband Daniel was so supportive. He did all the cooking in the house, and he always triple-checked everything I ate. I think my allergies were the main reason I hated Halloween so much. As a kid, I went trick-or-treating, but I never got to eat any of my candy. My allergies were so severe that even if a single Reese's peanut butter cup was in my bag, then all the candy near it was contaminated. My husband loved Halloween, though. It was his favorite time of year. He made sure to always buy me a giant bag of Tootsie Rolls, which of course didn't have any peanuts. It became sort of a tradition in our household, Daniel's yearly Tootsie Roll present. A few days before Halloween, I woke up in the middle of the night to find the rest of the bed empty. I could hear Daniel downstairs in the kitchen. I was a little curious. Daniel was the heaviest sleeper I knew. The only times he woke up at night were when he was sick. So I got out of bed and walked downstairs. Daniel didn't hear me come down. He was leaning over the kitchen counter spraying something. I walked a bit closer and could feel my throat start to constrict. I had to rush out of the room and grab my EpiPen, but not until after I saw exactly what Daniel was doing. He was spraying peanut oil onto this year's bag of Tootsie Rolls. I got back upstairs and injected myself. It took about a minute for me to be able to breathe properly again. Once I was back to normal, a horrible realization struck me. Daniel was trying to kill me. Thankfully, he didn't know that I'd caught him in the act. I could hear Daniel take a shower in the downstairs bathroom, probably to wash away all the peanut fumes. When he got back into bed, I kept my eyes closed and pretended to still be asleep. "Honey?" I heard him whisper. But when I didn't react, he fell asleep. All that night, my mind was restless. Why would Daniel do that? And more importantly, what should I do to protect myself? I decided to wait until morning and then take the bag of candy to the police. That had to be enough evidence of attempted murder, right? Once I made that decision, my brain calmed down enough for me to fall back asleep. The next morning, Daniel woke me up with breakfast in bed. He was acting really romantic, complimenting me on how naturally beautiful I looked in the morning. I told him I had a stomach ache and refused the breakfast. I didn't want to risk it. While Daniel got ready for work, I put on some gloves and grabbed the Tootsie Rolls from the cabinet, careful to hold the bag as far away from me as possible. I took it into my car and left. I was planning to take the evidence to the police, but as I drove, I pictured Daniel's smiling face. I thought about how kind he was acting this morning. The image made me angrier than I'd ever been. I was less than a minute away from the police station when I made a U-turn. I decided not to get the police involved. I was going to handle this situation myself. I hid the peanut-coated bag of Tootsie Rolls in the trunk and went to Walmart to buy an identical bag. Then I went back home and placed it exactly where the other had been. Then I found the spray can of peanut oil hidden under the sink and threw it in the trash, just in case. Daniel left for work, completely oblivious to the switch. I spent the rest of the day filled with both anger and nervousness. Deep down, I knew I should have gone to the authorities, and I still could. I had the evidence in my trunk, but in the end, I didn't. Daniel came home a bit earlier than usual, explaining that he wanted to savor our time together. He didn't realize how suspicious that sounded. Once again, he acted sweet and affectionate, which only made me angrier. While he sat on the couch watching TV, I went into the kitchen and came back with the Tootsie Roll bag. Daniel's eyes widened. "Those are for Halloween." "I know," I told him. "But I just had a craving. It's okay to eat a few, right?" He squirmed in his seat, trying to figure out what to say, until he eventually gave in. "Okay, why not?" I sat on the chair across from him, the candy bag in my lap. I pretended to cough. He watched nervously as I opened the bag and unwrapped my first piece. "We really should wait for Halloween," he tried one more time. I just smiled at him and tossed the candy into my mouth. I chewed it for a long time as I watched his reaction. "It tastes different," I lied. He didn't say anything. He was holding onto the sofa cushion so tightly that I could see the veins in his hands. He was waiting for me to start choking. So I gave him what he wanted. I bulged out my eyes and forced myself to cough. I'd had enough real allergy attacks in the past to know exactly what it would look like. "EpiPen!" I gasped out. As I faked my reaction, I paid close attention to my husband's face. It was frighteningly blank, with not an ounce of surprise. I twisted my body and reached toward him.
"EpiPen!"
I said again. He pulled the EpiPen out of his pocket. He held it up for me to see, but he didn't leave his seat. He was taunting me with it.
"Why?"
I croaked, holding my breath so that my face would turn red. He smiled, but there was nothing behind his eyes. "I hate you from every inch of my heart," he said. "But I love your money." That was all the explanation I needed. My husband, my soulmate, hated me. Perhaps he always had. With one final gasp, I pretended to die. I made my body go completely limp, and I flopped my tongue to the side. He didn't react for a while, and I worried that he saw through my acting. But then he got to his feet, let out a cold laugh, walked over, and grabbed my feet. "Rest in peace, my love." He pulled me onto the floor and dragged me toward the back door. That was probably the hardest part of my roleplay, but thankfully we didn't have any stairs outside our door. It was a clean shot from the living room into the backyard. He pulled me onto the grass and left me there. I could have jumped up and run away, but curiosity forced me to stay perfectly still. With my eyes half opened, I saw Daniel return with a shovel. I felt a smile spread across my face, but he thankfully didn't notice. After that, I heard him digging a hole just a few feet away. I don't know how long I waited, perfectly still, but it must have been at least an hour. Finally, I heard a thunk as he dropped the shovel and climbed out of the hole. He was panting from the effort. I felt his hands once again grab my feet. Just as he was about to chuck me into the hole, I kicked him as hard as I could. He flew backwards, landing with a crunch. I stood up to get a better look. He was lying on the bottom of the hole, whimpering and cradling his freshly broken arm. The hole wasn't very deep, but it was deep enough for him to need both arms to pull himself up.
"Get me out of here!" he screamed.
"Sure," I said. "As soon as you tell me why you tried to kill me."
"I already did,"
he whimpered. All he had was a broken arm, but he was acting like such a baby.
It was for your money."
"Thanks for confessing. That's all we needed to hear,"
I said. I looked at our three neighbors, who had run over as soon as they heard the screams. Daniel couldn't see them over the edge, but they heard everything. That's when I finally called the police. Two months ago, my brother Nicholas went missing. He left for work one day and never came home. The police found his car in a ditch 3 days later, but no one ever found his body. I knew right away that he'd been murdered. I just had a feeling in my gut. But my sister Kate, the baby of the family, always insisted that he was still out there. I didn't have the heart to tell her that he was gone forever. One day she'd realize it herself. On the weekend before Halloween, we both got invited to a house party just outside of town. I wasn't in the mood for it, but Kate insisted that I come along. She said it would be a nice way to honor Nicholas, because Halloween was his favorite holiday. I wore normal clothes and cat ears, which was barely a costume. Kate dressed like a nun. When we arrived at the party, it was already in full swing. There must have been dozens of people inside. Just as we were about to enter, Kate noticed someone standing in the distance. He was wearing a full-body skeleton costume, the exact same skeleton costume that Nicholas wore every Halloween. I thought it was just a coincidence, but Kate swore that it was him. She called out to the man.
"Nicholas, is that you?"
He glanced back at us and then started to run into the woods behind the house. Kate immediately chased after him.
"Wait!"
I screamed, but she had already disappeared into the trees. I couldn't let her go in there alone. Who knows who that masked man really was, or how dangerous he really was. I had to catch up to them. The woods were extremely dark, and aside from the party music in the distance, everything was very, very quiet. I saw movement up ahead. Kate was rounding a corner. I couldn't see the other guy. When I finally caught up with her, she was standing in front of an empty cabin. Its windows were boarded up, and it looked like no one had lived there for a long, long time.
"He went inside," Kate whispered to me. "I know, it's Nicholas."
I begged her to go back with me. We shouldn't enter a place like this, not in the middle of the night. Not without backup. She wouldn't listen. She took my hand and started pulling me toward the door. I knew there was nothing I could say to stop her, so I went along. The inside of the cabin was lit with candles. Kate hurried through the bare living room and into the dark hallway just beyond.
"He's this way,"
she said, not explaining why she knew that. I joined her in the hallway, and after my eyes adjusted to the darkness, I saw that she was right. The skeleton man was standing at the end of the hall, stock still, waiting for us to come closer.
"Nicholas?"
Kate whispered as she approached. There was a hole in the floor that I would not have noticed. Thankfully, Kate did. She walked around it before she reached the man in the costume. She wrapped him in a big hug.
"Oh, Nicholas! I knew it was you!"
"Get away from him," I said. "That's not Nicholas." He was at least 3 inches taller than our brother. He had wider shoulders, too. The man hugged her back, but he seemed to be squeezing her really tight. Too tight. I carefully tried to pull Kate away from him. I almost did. Then suddenly the man let go and pushed us both backwards. Kate fell to the side, but I toppled backwards right into the hole in the floor. I landed in the dark basement below, my ankle snapping under me. I screamed in pain. The only light came from the hole above. I saw both Kate and the man look down at me. The man finally pulled off his mask, revealing a familiar face. It was Jason, Kate's on-again, off-again boyfriend.
"Oops," he said, and Kate laughed.
"What's going on?"
"Turn to your left, babe,"
Kate called down at me. There was a body to my left. Nicholas's body. He was bloated and rotting.
"You left him here to die?"
I asked.
"Yep," Kate said. "And we're going to do the same thing to you."
They both disappeared from view. I could hear their thumping footsteps upstairs, and then the basement door creaked open, and the pair stepped down toward me. They took their sweet time. Knowing that with my broken leg, I was trapped down there. I was at their mercy. Kate held a candle in one hand, the only source of light down here. Jason brought a box of rat poison and set it down next to me. They both stripped off their costumes so they could get more comfortable before they killed me.
"Why?"
I whimpered. Kate laughed and said, as casually as possible, that she wanted all our family inheritance for herself. With me and Nicholas out of the picture, she and her boyfriend could take all our family's money for themselves.
"And no one will ever find your body," Jason bragged.
He was immediately proven wrong when someone shouted at us from outside the house. Someone had followed us from the party.
"Hello? Do you need help?"
"Don't go anywhere," Kate told me. "We'll kill you when we get back."
They took the candle with them, leaving me in total darkness with my brother's dead body while they dealt with the stranger. I thought about calling for help, but I knew that if the guy heard me, then Kate would probably just kill him too. I had a better idea. Wincing through the pain, I crawled towards the box of rat poison. Their discarded costumes were crumpled on the ground a few feet away. I sprinkled most of the poison onto the inside of their costumes, keeping my mouth and eyes squeezed shut in case any of it splattered on me. Then I crawled back to my original spot on the floor and put the box of poison back where they'd left it. I could hear their voices outside the house. They were making up some lame story about doing a séance in a haunted house. The guy seemed to buy it. Pretty soon, the man had left, and my would-be killers returned to the basement.
"I'm so sorry I have to do this," Kate told me. "But you understand why I'm killing you, right?"
The only way I could get out of here alive was if I could trick them into putting their costumes back on. Thankfully, My sister was easily manipulated. You're missing the Halloween party. People are gonna notice.
Then we should kill you fast, she argued.
Or, I said, and hear me out, you leave me here. I'm obviously not going anywhere. Once you've had your fun, you can come back and finish me off. The two of them looked at each other, considering my suggestion. With a shrug, they both slipped their costumes back on, neither noticing the poison coating the fabric. Jason left right away, but Kate stomped down on my other ankle, breaking that one too.
Just in case, she taunted before she left.
Once again, alone in the dark basement with my brother's body just a few feet away, I passed out from the pain. The next thing I knew, I was laying in a hospital bed with casts on both legs. A policeman sat by my bedside, waiting for me to wake up. He explained that he'd been called to the Halloween party after Kate and Jason had dropped dead in the middle of the dance floor. The poison had soaked into their bodies as they danced. The cop found me and Nicholas pretty soon afterward. He knew what I'd done, but he wasn't going to press charges. All he said was, "Good job."
I'm not really into keeping old furniture around, but that couch was different. It had been with me through the better part of the last decade. It was a hand-me-down from an ex. She loved the thing, always draping it in blankets like it was some sacred artifact. I always thought it was ugly. It was mid-century modern with green and yellow stripes. After she left me, I found myself increasingly irritated by its presence. So, after another night of sitting on its overhyped cushions, I finally decided it had to go. I listed it on Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace. It was a simple post, just a few photos and a short description. Old couch, worn but comfortable, free to anyone who can pick it up. Within 5 minutes, I got a response. That was a red flag I should have caught. The buyer messaged me through Craigslist and Facebook. That should have been a red flag. Who gets that excited over an ugly couch? The guy introduced himself as Jared. He fired off messages faster than I could read them. "I'll be there tonight," one read. "Can I come sooner?" another said. I told him I wouldn't be available until the evening, but that didn't stop him from repeatedly asking if I could make an exception. I made him wait for when I was available, and he messaged me until I told him he could come. When Jared finally showed up, I instantly regretted putting the ad up. He was tall, with a thick beard and eyes that darted nervously around the room. He didn't come alone either. A woman stood by the door. She was tall and slender, and looked as uneasy as Jared, though she never spoke. Jared practically pounced on the couch the moment I let them in, rubbing his hands over the fabric like it was made of gold. "This is the one," he mumbled, almost to himself. "You don't know what you've got here, man." It's just a couch," I replied, trying to laugh off his odd behavior. Jared's head snapped up, and he smiled. "Yeah, sure, just a couch." Something about the way he said it made me uneasy, but I didn't care enough to dig into it. If the guy wanted the couch that badly, he could have it. He handed me $50, even though I told him it was free. I took the cash, figuring it was the quickest way to get him out of my apartment. They struggled with the couch for a few minutes, maneuvering it awkwardly through my front door, and then, just like that, they were gone. I felt a wave of relief. The couch was out of my life for good. I didn't give it another thought, until around midnight, when I got a text from an unknown number. "You shouldn't have let it go." I stared at the message, my stomach turning. Before I could reply, another message came in. It belonged to someone important. My mind raced as I stared at the phone, trying to figure out what was going on. I hadn't mentioned the couch to anyone else. The messages kept coming, growing more aggressive with each one. "You've made a mistake. They're watching you." That's when I decided to dig into the history of the couch. I had never really considered where it came from. Years ago, my ex picked it up from a secondhand store, and that was that. But now, something felt off. I needed to know more. I called the store where she'd bought it. The owner barely remembered the couch, but told me that it had been part of an estate sale. That got my attention. Estate sales usually meant that someone had died, and from the way Jared had acted, I had a bad feeling about this particular death. I dug more, and eventually found a local news article from about 12 years ago. It detailed the murder of a young woman, Claudia Holloway, in her upscale downtown apartment. She had been found dead on her couch. The article didn't detail the couch itself, but I only needed a photograph of the crime scene. Sure enough, there it was, as ugly as the day Jared and his friend carried it away. Except, in the picture, the green and yellow stripes were stained with blood. The article didn't include any details of the murder. I sat there in the dark, staring at the photograph, debating whether this could be my couch or not. For all I knew, IKEA made the couch and everyone had one like it. Although it wasn't in IKEA's minimalist style, I abandoned that excuse. It didn't make any sense. Why would anyone be so obsessed with a piece of furniture? But then again, Jared's strange behavior would make some sense if he knew about this murder. And those texts, they're watching you. Who were they? As I dug deeper, I found out that Claudia Holloway wasn't just some random victim. She came from money. Old money. The kind of money that didn't just go away after someone died. Her family must have been one of influence because they were the ones behind the Holloway Library, Holloway Park, and, according to my research, they made sizable donations to the current mayor. The police investigation into her murder had been suspiciously quiet, too. The case had gone cold quickly, and the couch had eventually disappeared into the ether of estate sales and secondhand shops. But why was it so important? I found out the next morning when two men showed up at my door. At first, I thought they were cops, but they didn't look like cops. They looked more like businessmen, with clean-cut, tailored suits and stern faces that looked like they meant serious business. The taller of the two spoke first. "We're here to talk about your couch," he continued. "You should have never let it go." I swallowed hard, trying to keep my voice steady. "What's so important about a couch?" The other man's lips curled into a tight smile. "It's not the couch that's important, it's what's hidden inside." My heart skipped a beat. "Inside?" He nodded. "The family who originally purchased the couch had secrets they didn't want anyone to find. That couch was custom built to hide something valuable, something dangerous." My mind raced. Was that why Jared had been so obsessed with it? Did he know about the hidden compartment? The second man, who had been silent until now, stepped forward. "We don't care who has it. We just need to make sure it stays buried. Do you understand?" I nodded, my throat dry. "Yeah, I get it." The two men exchanged a glance before the taller one spoke again. "Good. Then we won't have a problem. Is the couch here?" I shook my head. "No, some man named Jared took it last night." The men looked at each other. The tall one let out a deep sigh. "Do you know this man's last name?" My hands were shaking as I took my phone out of my pocket to show the man Jared's Facebook profile. When I clicked on it, I found the profile had been deleted. Sorry, I don't know his last name. But I can give you his number." One of the men pulled up a picture on his phone. "Did he look like this?" Sure enough, he showed me a picture of Jared. I nodded. They turned and left without another word, leaving me standing there, heart pounding, in the doorway. I didn't sleep that night. I couldn't. I kept thinking about what might be hidden inside that couch. Something so important that people were willing to threaten me to keep it hidden. I thought about Jared, too. What had he gotten himself into? The next morning, I tried to call him, but the number he'd given me was disconnected. He had vanished, just like the couch. A week went by with no word from Jared, no more strange messages, and no sign of the two men in suits. I started to think that maybe it was all over. The couch and whatever secrets it held were gone for good. But late one night, I heard a knock on my door. When I opened it, there was nothing there. Just a small envelope taped to the doorframe. Inside was a single piece of paper with a message written in neat, careful handwriting. Some secrets should stay buried. I never heard from Jared again. But every so often, I still think about that couch and what it might have been hiding. I wonder if the people who wanted it buried are still watching me. I hope I never find out. My decision to move to Helensville was wholly logical. I had done my research of the place. Helensville was nestled smack in the middle of hills and whispering woods. The air in Helensville carried a hint of sweet honeysuckle, wafting in gentle breezes that never ceased. It was perfection at first impression, and I could not imagine that there was such a place for me in a world like this. The streets in the neighborhood were wide macadam tarred, lined with trees and greenery that formed natural canopies from the sunlight. The buildings were modern constructions, with hints of an era in the last century when materials seemed to be of better quality and lasted longer. The craftsmanship was evident in the uniqueness of each home. Helensville had one bookstore, and it was close to the market square. The cafes, however, featured more, even though patrons were infrequent to dining out. I took regular evening strolls and stopped at the cafes and the bookstore often when I moved to Helensville, but it quickly got boring. The people were vibrant, but they were not present. The tranquility was a haven, a sanctuary that felt compelled to nurture for as long as they could. It was this that first informed my unease about the place. My life had become too routine for my liking, because back in the city, from where I had moved to Helensville, there was always the element of spontaneity. The idea that anything could happen was exciting. It was one of the simple joys of life that I had overlooked until I did not have it. I spoke to one of the hosts at a cafe I frequented, and he told me about Craigslist, and how I could make friends in Helensville through Craigslist easily. He mentioned that Helensville had a naturally snobbish society, and the only way people got to know each other was by finding hobbies that they shared amongst themselves. I thanked him for his suggestion, and that same evening, I was on Craigslist to find friends. It was not long before I found a small group that had hiking as a connecting hobby. The head of the group was a bloke named Tom. Tom was a chatter, charismatic and friendly as he was. He seemed a simple character, and we established some rapport between ourselves in a matter of hours when he revealed to me that I was just in luck, and he would be going on a hiking expedition into the woods in a matter of days. He asked me to join, and I, sensing no danger in his request, obliged him. I was going to make friends at last, it seemed, and I made plans towards having a good first impression. On the day of the hike, I was prepared for any eventuality because I was of the idea that we could encounter a bear or any beast in the woods and it would be good to have some defense. I kept the thought to myself to not appear strange to the others, who would not be taken to the fact that I had brought a gun to the expedition. It was a nice surprise to finally meet Tom in person, who was effusive and just as charming. He was a man in his 30s, even though he had a noticeable stomach pouch. He was bald, but hairy on his arms and legs. Neatly shaven, Tom looked like every other regular person in Helensville. He complimented my outfit and said he wished he had a hiking backpack like mine for himself. I humbly laughed it off and told him it was easy to get as I'd gotten it at the store. "We will be very good friends, Cameron," he said to me, and reached his hands out for a handshake. The first handshake I'd gotten in weeks. I shook his hands with no fear at all, and I suspect at this point I let a bit of my guard down. There was nothing about Tom that betrayed his intention. He said we would have to wait on another hiking member resident in Helensville before we would go. In 10 minutes, we were joined by another hiking member, and then it was time for us to leave. I guess we have the main trail maps, Tom said to us. I nodded and turned sideways to see the other member also nodding affirmatively. What the hell with a map, eh? You want to see something cool? You always know the coolest spots, Tom, the other member said, and they both giggled. So I giggled because it would be strange to not do so. Trust me, it's nothing like you've ever seen, Dominic, Tom said to him in camaraderie. Y'all go on these expeditions together often? I quizzed. They nodded, and Tom turned around to lead the way down the trail. We walked down the trail for a while, and Tom ranted about the secret spot he was taking us to and how beautiful it was to view the hills from up there. Before I could reconcile all of it, Tom had taken the other route, and we were headed in a direction that only he knew. I marched with caution, carefully treading, as I had no idea what could be in the bushy parts of the trail. We were 20 minutes away from the main trail when the most potent danger, one which I had not envisaged but prepared for anyway, appeared. Tom's true intentions. Take off your watch, Tom said to me as he flashed a knife at me once he sensed the sudden confusion in my appearance. All of the common cues of dangers which I had missed earlier rushed to my mind, and I was dizzy from the thought of it. Why are you doing this to me? I asked. And before I could take the watch off my hands, Dominic, the other hiking member, revealed himself to be part of the plan, snatching the watch from my wrist forcefully. It's a robbery, my dumb friend. We don't live in your posh estate, so you'll never find us. Dominic added to my terror when he showed off a blade so sharp it refracted sunlight. The sight of such a blade and the menace in both their eyes had me visibly shaken, but I tried to maintain my calm. It was obvious that they would do me harm in an instant if I moved in a way that they did not like. Give us all your valuables and you may live, Tom muttered and poked his knife at me. The knife cut my thick cargo vest, and he sliced it to show me he was not joking. I was scared for my life, and I watched it flash before my eyes as I asked them to allow me to take off my bag and bring out what was valuable. The bait on their curiosity worked, and they allowed it. So I ransacked my bag in the way that I knew I had arranged all of my stuff. My heart was beating so fast in utter dread because if they knew what I was doing, they would not hesitate to finish me off. Thankfully, they had no clue until I brought the gun out to turn the tide. Get down on your knees, I hollered to their shock, directing Dominic to Tom. They obeyed at the sight of my weapon. I'm calling the cops. They remained on their knees until the cops found us, because even though I was scared as hell out there, it was obvious to me, as it was to them, that I would not hesitate to pull the trigger. They were arrested, and I found my way back to civilization, with a learnt lesson to never trust people so easily.